Hope you're enjoying your lunch. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters News, and I'm one of the newer additions to the Board of Governors here at FCC. Just a couple of housekeeping notes before we get started. Please do remember to switch off your mobile phones. And also, we're going to take a small break over Chinese New Year's in terms of luncheons and speakers, but our next event up after this one will have Mr. Humphrey Hawksley on Thursday, the 10th of February. For those of you who aren't familiar with that well-known name, he's a leading BBC foreign correspondent. He's an author and commentator on world affairs, and he'll be here to speak with us and tell us about his experiences. Meanwhile, on to the main event of the day. We have obviously been blitzed with headlines about state visits to the United States on China. But as we start the year, a quick snapshot. We saw the Shanghai stock market down 14% last year. I think that was one of the worst performing markets of the major stock markets in the world. Inflation on the rise in China, people concerned about it. Also, wage rises in China. Where does that leave us as we head into 2011? Well, I'm pleased to introduce Jing Aldrich, a popular visitor to this club, for her perspective. She'll give us a brief few remarks, and then we'll open it up to questions. For those of you who aren't aware, Jing is managing director and chairman of China Equities at JP Morgan, and very well known across the world for her comments. Jing?
Good afternoon, everyone. Tara, thank you very much for your kind introduction. I'd like to thank the FCC, Keith, Anna, Tara, and others for inviting me back to the FCC for a beginning of the year lunch presentation. I think I spoke here in each of the last 3 years. Now, we have entered 2011 with China on course to achieve a soft landing after a year of extraordinary expansion in money supply, in fiscal spending. Now, we have also a problem on our hands, which is inflation. So inflation plus concerns about overheating have many market observers quite worried about the prospects for 2011. Now, I would argue China's economic fundamentals remain extremely strong. The Chinese authorities clearly have put the Chinese domestic economic house in order during the financial crisis, enabling the country to set the course for the next 5 years without the basic growth concerns that are facing so many other large economies. However, in the last 10, 15 years, China's economic growth model has also resulted in a number of imbalances, which, if unresolved, could really result in social instability. And these imbalances, as you know, are income disparity, the uneven growth rates of the coastal region and the inland regions, uneven access to social benefits, including housing. Now, in the next several years, especially as we start the 12-5-year plan, the Chinese authorities will seek to cultivate a more sustainable path of growth. And of course, in the shorter term, in 2011, the immediate priority for the Chinese leadership is basically to bring inflation under control. Now, before I go into my presentation, I'd like to get a gauge of the sentiment in this room. I'm going to ask three very simple questions. If your answer is yes, please raise your hand. My first question is inflation. Are you concerned about inflation? If so, raise your hand. How many are concerned about inflation? So that's about, 85, 90% of the room. Second question, are you positive on the outlook for the Chinese economy? If so, if yes, raise your hand. That's the vast majority of this room, I think. And thirdly, are you bullish on the outlook for commodities? If so, raise your hand. That's, I don't know, maybe 80%, 75% of the room? Okay, that's good. So during today's presentation, I'm going to, first of all, talk about the nearer term policy outlook for China in 2011. Secondly, I will talk about some of the structural trends in the medium to long term. And finally, investment implications. I'll touch upon those issues such as inflation, also commodities, during my remarks. Now, first of all, we cannot really begin to talk about long-term issues without talking about China's inflationary picture. Now, first of all, you can look at this graph. I'm showing you PPI. China's PPI in the month of December actually dropped ever so slightly compared to the previous months, 5.9% versus 6.1% in November. CPI, as you can see here, also dropped slightly to 4.6%. And the previous month in November, CPI, of course, was 5.1%. But CPI remains a major concern of the Chinese leadership as well as the populace in general. One of the key reasons why CPI has remained elevated is because of food. As you can see here, food prices during the second half of 2010 rose quite substantially, although in the month of December, after a slew of measures introduced by the central government, food prices have dipped a little bit to about 9.6%. That's against 11.7% in the previous month. Nonetheless, inflation remains a major concern of the Chinese leadership. Now, the government basically has launched an all-out campaign against inflation. Just before Christmas, Premier Wen Jiabao did a radio talk show to all the citizens in China. He said, "Your words, the citizens' words, hurt my heart. The Chinese government has already introduced 16 measures to bring down food inflation." And the premier expressed confidence to bring inflation down. Now, if you think about inflation, China is now caught between rising demand from an ever-affluent population and shorter supply, especially in terms of food. In the recent months, the central government said we will increase vegetable acreage in the new year by over 7%. And also just last week, during President Hu Jintao's visit to Washington, China signed a major contract to purchase more soybeans from the U.S. The contract basically amounted to 8.45 million tons of soybeans, and that is worth 4.8 billion US dollars. And that is the single biggest purchase of soybeans in a single day by China. Last year in 2010, Chinese soybean imports also went to a record, reaching some 54 million tons. The reason why you're seeing China importing more raw materials, including food, such as soybeans and corn, is because the diet of the Chinese population is changing quite rapidly. People eating more protein, more meat, therefore you need more soybeans and corn to feed the livestock. So it is clear at this juncture, the task of containing inflation is the most immediate policy priority in China, and one that really requires a high degree of monetary prudence. So to curb speculation, especially in food, the Chinese government has even gone so far as to enact temporary price controls. So in the coming few months, I would expect inflation to be the number one challenge facing policymakers in China. Now, we know inflation at the end of the day is a monetary phenomenon. So to tackle inflation, the Chinese government has introduced a host of measures, not just containing food prices, but on the monetary policy front, they've tightened the reserve requirement ratio for banks for 7 times already since the beginning of 2010. And in the new year, there's a new policy which is now being summarized in this new acronym called D2R3. Who knows what that refers to? D2R3. I hate to throw economic jargons around, but this is now in the newspapers quite a lot. So what is D2R3? Well, D2 stands for dynamic, differentiated, R3, RRR, meaning Chinese banks now face different rates of RRR based on their lending pace. You know, if you are lending too fast as a bank, you are going to face higher reserve requirement ratio. But the overall reserve requirement ratio for banks has already gone to 19%, which is a record high. If some banks lend too fast, they may face D2R3, which is a dynamic differentiated RRR. So that means the central authorities are using the reserve requirement ratio to curb credit growth and to constrain liquidity in the banking system. We also have rate hikes. Clearly in 2010, China belatedly tightened interest rates first in October, and then we had that rate hike on Christmas Day. So only two rate hikes in 2010. And in 2011, we're expecting three rate hikes. We still have a negative real rates environment, and I think China has further room to tighten interest rates. And of course, administrative control. We mentioned the various controls the government has put on, especially in agriculture, but don't forget housing. So in the recent days, we're hearing quite a lot of noise coming from various parts of China about China's new property tax being introduced. Housing, of course, is a very important contributor to inflation, although home prices are not included in China's overall CPI. So it looks like in the coming few weeks, we are going to have the country's first property tax being introduced in cities such as Shanghai and Chongqing. And in the meantime, the central government will continue to tackle speculation, not just in housing, but also in food and commodities. Finally, RMB appreciation. We're projecting a faster rate of RMB appreciating in 2011 compared to 2010, when the RMB appreciated only 3.5%. In 2011, we're looking at an appreciation of 5%, which actually may be front-loaded to help contain some of the imported inflation. So by year end 2011, we're looking at an exchange rate of roughly 6.3 RMB against the US dollar. Now on the subject of RMB, in addition to letting the RMB appreciate at a steady pace, I also think the Chinese authorities want to make the RMB a more widely used international currency. Here in Hong Kong, we've seen a lot of news recently about the liberalization of the RMB. So I want to spend a minute or two on the impact of RMB, the reform of RMB, the exchange rate, as well as the liberalization of the currency and the impact on Hong Kong. So you can see here, this chart basically shows you the overall RMB deposit base in Hong Kong, which has grown extremely rapidly. You can see here, by the end of 2010, the RMB deposit in Hong Kong basically expanded by some 378%, reaching about 300 billion RMB. That's a huge increase compared to the beginning of the year. The Chinese authorities basically have undertaken to let the currency become more widely traded, and they have basically launched a wave of measures that dramatically broaden the scope for RMB business. So some of the key reforms are using RMB to in currency swaps with the emerging markets. You have also the Chinese and foreign institutions in Hong Kong being able to set up RMB accounts. They can buy and sell RMB without limits. In September of last year, the Chinese currency also crossed a notable milestone when the Malaysian Central Bank reportedly added a sum of RMB to its foreign exchange reserves. Now, in the earlier days of the new year of 2011, the Chinese policymakers are pushing ahead with incremental steps to expand the use of currency in Hong Kong and elsewhere. For example, the People's Bank of China announced that Chinese companies are permitted to take RMB from China to conduct mergers and acquisitions overseas. They can use RMB to invest in new ventures and also purchase stakes of companies overseas. Also, we heard that residents in the wealthy city of Wenzhou can take as much as 200 million RMB per annum outside of China for investment purposes. Also, just last week, Bank of China's New York branch began to offer RMB accounts, and individuals can exchange up to $4,000 per day. Of course, in Hong Kong, we are going to see more investment products. I think this year, sometime this year, we will see equity products in RMB being launched in Hong Kong, perhaps starting with REITs, and then more equity products will be launched here in the SAR. The new phenomenon of dim sum bond clearly attract a lot of interest. You can see here, I've listed a number of institutions, including the World Bank, including companies such as McDonald's, Caterpillar, Sinochem, et cetera, which all have raised dim sum bonds in Hong Kong, basically RMB bonds. And the benefit of raising an RMB bond in Hong Kong is that the cost is lower. You can pretty much issue a three-year bond for under, the interest rate now is under 2 to 3%. It's 1 percentage point lower compared to the interest in China. So a lot of international institutions and companies find it quite attractive to raise RMB bonds in Hong Kong. And clearly, as we said earlier, there's a large pool of deposits in Hong Kong which are seeking a home. This is one of the trends we're monitoring very closely in the new year, in addition to the ongoing appreciation of the Chinese currency. Now, let me move on to the next section, which is going to be long-term trends, long-term, medium-term trends, structural trends that will really define China's growth paths in the next 5 years. These four trends are, number one, we're looking at continued surge in labor cost, and that is really reflecting aging demographics. Second point, the rise of the Chinese consumer. I believe Chinese consumers are going to become vanguards of consumerism, not just in this part of the world, but also in other places as well. Thirdly, very positive on China's Go West campaign, which has just been extended by another 10 years. The program began in 2000. We're now sitting in 2011. The government extended the Go West campaign by another 10 years to 2020. And that is going to help reduce the income gap between the coastal region and the inland areas. And finally, we expect China's demand for commodities to be very strong going forward. This is mainly underpinned by major infrastructural spending in the coming few years, particularly in the western regions of China. Now, looking at the first trend, which is a rising labor cost, you can see here China's working population basically peaked already. China's working population, I should say, let me be specific, people between the age of 15 and 64, that age group will peak in 2015. But the younger working population, those between the ages of 20 and 39, already began declining in the year 2000. If you're an employer in China, you know there's a lot of pressure on wage cost. Recently, I was reading the Chinese press. I can't vouch for the accuracy of the story, but here you go. The story is about Zhejiang province, which this year, I think, needs some 2 million workers, but only 1 million people applied for 2 million jobs. So one of the companies in Zhejiang province became quite concerned about the inability to hire enough workers, especially after Chinese New Year. They actually did a job fair at a local prison. So they ended up employing 42 prisoners who are due to be released in 2 months' time. So this goes to show the pressure employers are under. They are now going so far as to employ people who are still in prison. So this is just one of the many anecdotes that we're hearing about the pressure on labor. I think the reason is quite clear. One, the previously unlimited pool of underemployed agricultural workers is beginning to shrink. Secondly, you have the generational change. A lot of the younger workers don't want to travel halfway across the country, live in dormitories. They prefer to stay in their hometowns, near their families and friends. And of course, as the chart here indicates, the pool of labor is beginning to shrink as well. So labor cost is definitely continuing to head up. So you can see here, basically, minimum wages in China overall between 2005 and 2009 increased by 17.9%. That's a compound annual growth rate. But in 2010, that growth rate accelerated to 22.6%. And just last week, Guangdong province again raised the minimum wage. This is the second time in a year now. The last minimum wage hike in Guangdong occurred in May of 2000. Now the new wage hike in Guangdong will take effect on March 1st of 2011. That's up another 18.6%. Basically, Guangzhou now has the highest minimum wage in the country. And I would expect other provinces and other municipalities to follow suit in the coming weeks. So you are seeing labor cost going up across the board. So companies are now beginning to think of ways to try and offset this labor cost increase. Some are moving to the hinterland. Some are raising prices to their end customers in the US and Europe. We will hear a lot more about this, I believe, this year. Some are trying to increase more automation and increase productivity. I recently traveled to Western China. What I heard time and again was that companies are migrating. Workers are no longer migrating. So you're seeing a lot of companies moving from the coastal regions to the hinterland, to Sichuan, to Yunnan, and other places. And the governments in those hinterland regions are offering quite attractive incentives for companies to move there. Now, with the increasing wages, we clearly are seeing Chinese consumers taking center stage. And China has become the largest consumer of nearly everything, you know, from beer to cars. And Chinese shoppers are going to gigantic shopping malls. They're beginning to consume more meat-based diets. And none of this, of course, is happening in isolation. So I'm just using China's extraordinary car sales as an example here. You can see in 2010, Chinese car sales reached 18.1 million units. That's up over 30% compared to the previous year. I traveled to Germany just before Christmas, and a lot of the German companies, Volkswagen, et cetera, are doing so well in China. Their workers in Germany are working overtime, and they're getting paid extra bonuses because China's car demand is so extraordinarily strong. Now, no aspect of China's consumer revolution, of course, is happening in isolation. This emergence of a huge car market is only part of many, many simultaneous changes that are taking place. We're seeing basically not just in goods, we're also seeing this in services. Just to give you an example here, think about travel. So these two growth rates basically indicate total domestic travel spending. Between 2001 and 2009, the compound annual growth rate of domestic tourism was 14.2%. So you can see by 2009, total spending on domestic travel reached some 1 trillion RMB. And that rate is going to double in the next several years. By 2015, you can see we're projecting 12% compound annual growth rate for domestic travel spending between 2009 and 2010. Just to give you an example, there's a hotel chain in China called Home Inn. It's a listed company, and the company has been very successful in the last couple of years. In 2011, this company, which already has, I think, 800 hotels in the economy hotel segment, is planning to launch a lot more new hotels this year. Guess how many they're going to open this year? They're literally opening one new hotel per working day. So it's really quite remarkable. And the company's earnings in the third quarter 2010 was excellent. the occupancy rates reached 97%. Another example is a C-Trip. As you know, if you travel to China frequently, you might have used C-Trip services. Third quarter earnings for C-Trip was up, I think, 46%. And earnings were up across the board, you know, from air tickets to hotel booking to travel packages. And the growth trend is set to continue in the new year. And of course, think about services. You know, we can think about it broadly. For example, online shopping. Some of you might have heard Taobao. Taobao is doing very well. It is basically the dominant online marketplace for China. In the first half of 2010, the company handled 97% more packages, more transactions, compared to the entire year of 2009.
On that, so fascinating, that is a very interesting statistic. I'm conscious that we're going to be short on time, and I know there's a lot of questions in the audience. So if we could have a few more minutes to wrap up and then,
sure,
and then get to the questions in the audience.
There are always so many things to talk about when it comes to China. Now, let me just quickly highlight a few of the important points that I want to make. So in addition to the rise of the Chinese consumer, China's Western development is also quite breathtaking. You can see here, these bars basically show GDP per capita for the eastern regions of China. Of course, it's been rising over the years. For Western China, you can see they've been rising. However, the eastern regions are still much better off compared to the Western regions. However, since 2000, you can see the ratio here. That's marked by that yellow line. In the eastern region, back in 2000, per capita GDP was 2.8 times higher compared to the western region. Today, 10 years later, the ratio has shrunken to 2.3%. So as China puts more money into the western regions, we are going to see a lot more investments, a lot more returns coming from the western regions of China, which is helping shrink the income gap between the two regions. When I was in the western part of China recently in Sichuan and Yunnan, one of the officials told me he was projecting 14.4% growth in each of the next 5 years for that region. I was wondering how precise, why 14.4%? And then suddenly I remembered the wonderful rule of 72, which I studied in my freshman economic class. If you want to double a number in 5 years, you basically grow that by 14.4%. 72 divided by 5 equals 14.4 exactly. So a lot of the officials in the western regions of China are clearly trying to accelerate the pace of growth in their regions, and which I think will definitely happen in the coming few years. So watch the growth of the western regions of China very closely. Now, let me go on to the final point, which is commodities. In terms of commodities, China is still very much dependent on the imports from, you can see here, oil to copper to iron ore. Chinese imports have been accelerating, and domestic production clearly is not enough to meet the rising demand of the country. So I would expect in the coming few years, China's demand for commodities to remain very robust. First of all, you've got 10 million units of affordable housing for 2011. That's up from 5.8 million units in 2010. China is going to spend 4 trillion RMB by 2020 building electric power grids, and that will require a lot of copper. I talked about copper in each of the last 2 years here, in 2009 and 2010. We've highlighted copper as one of the raw materials that will benefit from China's rising infrastructure spending, especially in upgrading electrical power grids. I now carry a copper pen. The pen itself is not worth very much money, but if I hold on to it long enough, it will appreciate in value. And then finally, China's high-speed rail program is really breathtaking. We know that total length of railways will reach some 120,000 kilometers by the year 2015. By the way, that target was originally for 2020. So the authorities basically increased the target or brought forward the target to 2015. And about 16,000 of the 120,000 kilometers of highways, of railways, will be high-speed rail. And 60% of the railways will be in the western parts of China. And of course, building high-speed rail or upgrading existing railways will be extremely material intensive. Now, finally, let me just say a few words about China's overall stock market performance. You can see here, MSCI Emerging Markets did well last year. The Old Country World did okay. The Hang Seng Index, and then the Chinese Asia Index actually went down some 14%, largely because of the concerns about macroeconomic tightening. But going into 2011, we believe there will be a host of beneficiaries, as I outlined in my remarks about the macro trends. As wages go up, as the consumer in China continues to spend, you will see beneficiaries in the following sectors: autos, branded retail, apparel, media, entertainment, and tourism. As China's efforts to build more affordable housing, develop the West, and upgrade infrastructure, we will see beneficiaries in the following sectors: building materials such as cement, glass, logistics, railway construction, and natural resources. So overall, I think as investors or business people, we all need to monitor these trends very closely as China continues to cultivate sustainable growth in the future years. The reason why we need to monitor these sectoral rebalancing and also regional rebalancing is because China's main efforts in the coming 5 years will be the centerpiece, will be cultivating more sustainable growth. And we know Chinese efforts to grow the economy, to rebalance the different sectors, will have far-reaching impact, not just domestically, but also on global markets. And the reason is that as China goes, so goes the rest of the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jing. We have a few minutes for questions. There are mics around the room, so please raise your hand and tell us your name and where you're from. All those questions lined up right on the veranda.
Thank you, Jing. Hi, Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. You talked about the wage increases, 20% wage increases expected this year. And you also talked about the government's efforts to get a grip on inflation. But surely a 20% wage increase is itself vastly inflationary. I mean, this is going to make the job of containing price rises next to impossible. If you're handing out 20% pay rises, itself is going to drive up prices. How on earth can we square the circle here?
Well, I think nominal wage increases are a longer-term trend for China, at least for the next 3 to 5 years. But a lot of employers are trying to increase their productivity, enhance automation, so at least they can try and contain unit labor cost. So as companies become more productive, the unit labor cost will not go up as much as the nominal wages that I just mentioned. Nonetheless, I think wage increases will be one of the key reasons why inflation in the coming several years will remain elevated. I think we are looking at 4.3% inflation for 2011, which is higher compared to 2010, clearly higher than the previous several years. I would think everyone needs to get comfortable with higher rates of inflation in China going forward, especially given the multiple pressure points from food to natural resources, from labor cost to monetary expansion.
Anyone else? Questions from the audience? A quick question from Mi Jing. I mean, you mentioned inflation and some other economic risks, but what do you think could be some of the main risks to your scenario this year? Anything aside from inflation that could really dent growth and dent the stock market as well?
Well, I think what we're looking at is the pace of credit growth, which the authorities are very keen to contain. Loan growth in 2010 basically exceeded forecast. We had 7.95 trillion yuan in new loans when the target was only 7.5 trillion. And that doesn't even include the trust products, you know, products banks sold onto trust companies. So in 2009, 2010, in the 2 years since the financial crisis, China's money growth, monetary base grew basically by 50%. So no wonder we have inflation. So the concern for 2011 is whether the authorities are going to be successful in bringing down overall credit growth. In the first 2 weeks of 2011, we know credit growth was actually quite rapid. That's why the central government raised the reserve requirement ratio a few days into the new year in response to the rapid pace of credit growth. So in addition to inflation, we are concerned about the ability of the central government containing the credit growth, which at the end of the day contributes directly to inflation.
Anyone else? Keith.
With everybody expecting at least some further increase in the RMB, can China continue to control hot money inflows effectively?
There are a lot of barriers to bringing RMB back on shore in China. I mentioned all these policies of liberalizing RMB. When you raise bonds in Hong Kong in RMB, if you want to deploy the proceeds back into China, you would need to get the approval of the State Administration for Foreign Exchange. So there are a lot of stringent steps to take before one can legally bring money back into the mainland of China. So the regulations are in place, but we know China's capital account is quite leaky. You know, people can take money into China in various ways. This is one of the concerns of the market players, because some of the measures may not be effective. Some of the enforcement of China's capital controls may not be 100% effective in keeping money outside of China. I think this is inevitable, actually. It's a problem not just facing China, but also facing other emerging markets. As QE2 unleashes huge quantities of money, many other emerging markets, including Asia, Latin America, et cetera, are basically seeing huge amounts of money flowing into their countries. Therefore, inflation is a common phenomenon, not just in China, but also in places like India, Indonesia, Brazil.
I'm To Han Shi from South China Morning Post. In relation to this RMB issue, there's some Western economists say, according to the theory of thought in Western university, this renminbi internationalization is just shallow or doesn't amount to much because Chinese capital account is still closed. And some other people even have this conspiracy theory that playing up this renminbi internationalization in Hong Kong is just a show to make Hong Kong feel happy and complacent while they secretly make Shanghai the top financial center of China. What do you say to these theories?
Well, I think it is more than just for show. I think in the coming few years, you will see more investment products being launched in Hong Kong. The liberalization of the RMB will follow several steps. Number one, it needs to become more freely tradable. Secondly, you need more investment products for people who hold the deposits to buy into. So as I said, in 2011, we're anticipating some equity or equity-like products to be launched in Hong Kong. And eventually, as the RMB becomes freely convertible on the current account, it will become one of the major international reserve currencies. Countries such as Malaysia have already bought into RMB as one of the reserve currencies. However, the quantity of purchase, I believe, is still quite limited. So it needs to follow several steps. All this liberalization, all these measures we've seen, obviously give Hong Kong a few good factor, as Hong Kong is going to be the major offshore RMB transaction center. But I think the policies are more than just for show. I think these are concrete steps to liberalize the RMB, making the RMB, in the medium term, an international currency.
Jing, thanks very much. I think we'll leave it on that note. Thanks very much for being with us today. And we won't let you get away without a small token of appreciation from the club.
Small gift for the road. Thank you very much.
Thank you.